Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Roughly 40 years ago, a broad movement emerged in our nation in response to abuses of the environment, water and air pollution, toxic waste, habitat destruction, and extermination of wild species. Mass organizations were formed, new laws passed, and decades of work and political battles have ensued. In many areas, environmental progress has been made, posing a new challenge. When good things happen, what happens to the old battle lines and to the organizations that have fought those battles? Take the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, called GYC. For 30 years, it's been immersed in the battle to protect grizzly bears, with bear numbers rebounding dramatically in and around Yellowstone Park. What does GYC do now? Here to discuss this are Caroline Bird, the organization's executive director, and Scott Christensen, its conservation director. Many thanks to you both for joining us on Home Ground. Carolyn, tell us a little about your background. Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
Oh, Brian, I grew up in California. My folks came to California from England in the 50s, and we ended up living and growing up in West Los Angeles.
Now, how does one develop a conservation interest in western Los Angeles?
I grew up in Topanga Canyon. I didn't know I lived in a giant city. We played in the creek, had trails through the chaparral, and went to the ocean. So those mountains and ocean and creek and living and running around outside most of my childhood, I was infused with a love for nature, and it was just became part of me. I've always known that this is my world and what I want to do.
Where did it lead you in terms of education?
I went to UC Santa Cruz and spent an awful lot of time, again, in the mountains. In
this pretty nice place. I remember it.
Beautiful place. Mm-hmm. And I've chosen beautiful places to live.
What did you study?
Environmental studies and anthropology. I spent a lot of time in the Southwest with the Hopi Indians.
When you say you spent a lot of time with the Hopi, what does that mean?
We had to write a senior paper, and I wrote my paper on Hopi agriculture, and I spent a whole quarter on the reservation and kept going back to live with a family and work on corn harvest and spend time on the Hopi mesas. It was phenomenal.
If I asked you what you learned from that time with the Hopi that you didn't know beforehand, what would it be?
What I took away from that experience was their profound connection to the place that they lived and the stories and the myths, not myths, the stories that they had about each rock and promontory and how very much they belonged to their place, to their landscape. And their relationship with corn was all about their relationship both personally and as a society to the world, to the natural world. And that was a profound awakening to me, too, of the different ways people have of living on this planet and connecting to the natural world and how they express that.
Any education past undergrad?
Yeah, I did my graduate work, a master's work at the University of Montana, environmental studies again, and actually worked on grizzly bears and grizzly bear relationship conflicts with people.
And this would have been when, 80s?
In the 80s. Mm-hmm. Mm. And then I went back to Missoula for law school. I really like being a student.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, it was awfully fun, especially in Missoula.
Scott, how about you? Family background?
Yeah, Brian, I grew up mostly in the state of Idaho. And as I was finishing up high school, moved with my family down to Salt Lake City. My dad is in the marketing and branding world.
Commercial, not cattle branding, I'm assuming.
Commercial, yes, indeed.
All right.
And my mother is a hospice nurse.
So how about you? Where did you get your interest in nature?
Growing up in Idaho, I spent an awful lot of time running rivers, hiking up mountains with my family and friends, and that made a deep impression on me from there. You know, going back farther into my family, my dad comes from a very political family. My great-grandfather was elected twice to the House and once to the Senate. He was a New Deal Democrat from Beaver, Utah, and was very involved politically. And then my mom's side is from rural eastern Idaho. My mother grew up in Mud Lake, Idaho. And so I have this interesting background that involves politics, and then the rural West. And so for me, you know, being able to work at a place like the Greater Yellowstone Coalition and to work on issues involving land and water and wildlife is kind of the merging of those two, you know, parts of my family background together.
A fair part of a recent tradition would be, I would say, polarization between conservation and rural Western people. You have both in your family. You've chosen to work in the conservation field.
Mm-hmm.
Were you aware, by the way, I neglected to ask, how long have you worked for GYC?
11 years.
Okay, so you've been at it a while.
Mm-hmm.
Were you aware of the conflict going in, this tension between rural people and quote-unquote conservation or environmental organizations?
Oh, yeah. My mother's family still lives all scattered all around eastern Idaho. And I remember a conversation with my grandmother when I first started working for GYC. We sat down and she asked me what had brought me back to Idaho. And I said, well, I just got a job with an organization called the Greater Yellowstone Coalition. And I explained to her what GYC mm-hmm. did. And she looked at me with just complete amazement and said, I just cannot believe they'll pay somebody to do that kind of thing. And it was kind of a mix of, you know, her being astounded and mortified at the same time. And so I, for as long as I can remember, I have felt and known that intersection between conservation issues and the rural West, especially in places like eastern Idaho. And I think it shaped me and the way I look at the world and the way I approach these issues. And, you know, I joke with people sometimes that for better or worse, I'm related to half of eastern Idaho. And it gives me, I think, an insight into how to get things done in a place like that.
I think your stories kind of frame up one of the central issues of environmental conservation. Caroline, you were getting out of graduate school or in school in the 80s. It's the 70s that we saw a lot of the environmental legislation, and I'm going to say it grew out of perceived abuses of natural resources and wildlife by industrial and government interests over time. And there's been set in motion because of that reaction what I'm going to call a litigation, adversarial, oppositional dynamic, stopping bad things from happening. And that's gone on for 20, 30 years. And I think your grandmother's response is a reflection of that, I'll call it polarization. Now, Caroline, how did that come into your world in terms of your work, the polarization versus the potential over time of looking for opportunities to cooperate with people?
That's a good, I mean, it's an evolution, isn't it? I mean, when in the 80s, I came to the West, to the Rocky Mountain West, as a seasonal for the Forest Service. I worked trails and was a wilderness ranger on the Shoshone National Forest in Wyoming. So I was part of the Forest Service, and I also saw what was going on in the agency in the 80s. There was an awful lot of timber, an awful lot of road building, and, mm-hmm. and a real pulling away from the jobs that I was doing in the backcountry. So I think that we saw a lack of trust in this agency. This well-respected agency was doing things that was pretty shocking to a lot of us. Look at what was happening on the Caribou Targhee on the western side of the Greater Yellowstone, just massive clear cuts. Now, the evolution of that, I think we've gone from playing defense to
the environmental community.
Exactly. You know, the Forest Service is a different agency now, full of different people. It's no longer, we don't have to play defense as much as we did in the past. And we have to evolve along with what's happened on the ground. Now we're working on cleaning up some of all those roads that are legacies of the past practices. We're working together to prioritize where roads need to be taken out, where culverts need to be redone, where we can restore fish-bearing streams. It's a whole different playing field than it used to be. And those of us who've been doing this work for a long time have seen that change. We've been part of it.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about the history of environmental activism, with Caroline Bird, Executive Director of the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, and Scott Christensen, its Conservation Director. That's a very interesting description of the change in relationship with the agency, in the case, this case, the Forest Service, charged with multiple resource use. It doesn't go to the question of, let's say, the logging community or the motorized vehicle community, who probably see what you see as progress. Some of them would say, we lost a tremendous amount of ground. We were generating a lot of wood in the 80s. We had many roads being put in, which enhanced the kind of recreation we like. What's your sense for how that issue continues to evolve? In other words, you're working cooperatively in many ways with the agency. What's your sense as we sit here in 2014, either one or both of you, as to the degree to which there's still opposition from, let's say the logging industry as an example, or are there potential common ground opportunities there that emerge to you?
Oh, I think there's a lot of common ground opportunities. I mean, working with the logging community with the Forest Jobs and Recreation Act has been a real ground changer for us.
The tester bill. Are you guys supportive of that?
Yes, bill? Very much okay. So. We've been actively trying to get that passed and working with the Sun Mountain and other timber entities in the whole Haida Divide, and so that's been important to us. But I think more importantly, we've seen that just an economic shift or awakening as to the importance of the natural values, natural resources, the health of this place is essential to a healthy economy of this place. We all need this clean water, wildlife, recreational values, but it's why we all live here. So what the Greater Yellowstone provides is the economic engine for all of these communities.
When you say the Greater Yellowstone, it's mean the ecosystem as opposed to your organization.
The ecosystem, yes, exactly. The headwaters of the continent, all of our wildlife, this intact place with all of our species, we all live here because of what it provides. The wildlife, the water, the incredible scenic landscapes, that's the economic driver.
Scott, you look like you might want to add something to that.
Yeah, Brian, one of the things that I've observed in my time at GYC is that there are issues that can be very polarizing, like the ones we're talking about right now, and that when different sides of that, different people at different ends of those poles decide that they're not going to talk to each other anymore, then we go into kind of a stalemate situation. And one of the things I feel like I've learned over the past 10 or 11 years is that if we can sit down and talk about these things, we have an ability to peel back some of the layers of the onion. And what I've found is that 80-20 rule holds pretty firm for conservation issues, and that is that 20% of the things we may not be able to agree on, but 80%, I think if we strip back enough layers, we can agree that we share a lot of the same values. And I've seen that work in places like rural Idaho. I've seen it work in Wyoming. You know, one of the issues that we have worked on over the past 7 or 8 years was passing a bill to protect the Upper Snake River around Jackson as a wild and scenic river. And we worked with a lot of people in Wyoming over many years and ultimately had Senator Craig Thomas there carry the legislation.
Republican.
Mm-hmm. He passed away during the process, and Senator Barrasso came into the mix, and we were able to work with him and his staff.
Also a Republican.
And we're able to get that bill through Congress, and it was signed in 2009, and it protected about 400 miles of river on the Snake River. And so I think that we can, when we agree to sit down and talk about these issues rather than go off in our corner and not engage, then I think we can make some progress that benefits all parties.
Let's talk about this dynamic in relation to the grizzly bear. I go back probably pretty close to the beginning of GYC in terms of my awareness of the organization. And my sense is, for most of its history, my sense, is advocacy to protect habitat on national forest lands, multiple states, arguing for the existence of the ecosystem and actually being, in my view, remarkably successful as getting it into a term of usage, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem as an entity. A lot of that has been in the form of disagreements with the Forest Service on their forest practices, a lot of it around logging, roading, etc. So you come in, Caroline Byrd, you're fairly new here, about how long?
Almost a year.
Okay. You were aware of the organization's history?
Very much so.
Okay. Tell me about Caroline Byrd watching the GYC pre-coming in as executive director. What did you see? What did you see about the organization that appealed to you? Did it have some problems? What was your perspective?
I think GYC has got, well, it's got the best landscape in the world to work in. You know, we've got the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And as you say, we were pivotal in bringing that awareness and the coordination among the three states and all the forests and the Park Service, all the agencies. We were pivotal in bringing them together and looking at it as an ecosystem and making them manage it as an ecosystem and coordinate with each other.
I would just say almost 25 years ago when I was working for the Nature Conservancy, there was hesitancy in the definition among the agencies. That's over.
Pretty much. They now, Greater Yellowstone ecosystem now rolls off everybody's tongues.
Right.
It didn't used to. Which now, and so I think that's just become the standard way of operations, and we're seeing it with grizzly bears. I mean, that has become the way grizzly bears are managed. They're managed cooperatively among the states and the agencies, and that's a lot of the success. They're looking at the grizzly bear population as a ecosystem population, not state by state, not forest by forest. They have to coordinate, and we're really encouraged by that as the process of bears and bear management moves forward, is that they're coordinating it around this population.
Okay, now my sense is, and I don't follow this closely, that the population has increased very substantially. Can you give us some numbers?
Wait, yes. A few decades ago, we were looking at less than 200 bears. In the 80s, we were looking at less than 200 bears.
In the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem.
In the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. I'm just talking about this population of bears.
Right.
Now we have more than 700. That's success. We take a lot of credit for that, but we also give a lot of credit to our partners and to the agencies and who's been managed. You know, the emphasis on protecting and this bear and this place has been profound. It's a very well studied, understood population of wildlife, probably more than any other population in the world. We know more about these bears than just about anywhere else. So we're celebrating that success, but we're also, for the grizzly bear for us is iconic. It represents this whole place. If we have grizzly bears, we know we have good habitat, clean water, a functioning ecosystem. So grizzly bears mean a lot to us. We will continue to emphasize their survival, their persistence, and their expansion as they spread out of this core of protected lands. We're seeing bears in places we haven't seen them in decades. That's a good thing, but that means we need to work with people. More and more, it's people who will decide whether we have bears on this landscape or not.
Let me ask you that, because when you say they're going to move out, they're moving into areas that are inhabited by people. They run into hunters. I had the great special pleasure this year of bow hunting up in high country and seeing a sow and two cubs. Mm-hmm. So she taught them how to dig roots. I watched them for 45 minutes. I spent a lot of time in the woods. It was one of my great experiences for me. You have them going into rural subdivisions for garbage and bird feed. A bear was shot over to where I have a cabin near Reynolds Pass, a sow with cubs. So you have bear conflicts, fair?
Fair enough.
I assume that means you're now trying to reduce bear-human conflicts, and perhaps with some of the people that don't have a high value on the name Greater Yellowstone Coalition. Is that fair?
That is fair. Yeah.
How do you deal with it, Scott and you both?
That's one of the main emphases of our work right now. We've been doing it for a long time, but we need to do a lot more of it. We need to bear-proof this ecosystem. We've been focusing on those key places where conflicts are highest, like the area near Reynolds Pass, the Island Park, Henry's Fork area. We've been providing hundreds of bear-proof containers to contain those attractants, the garbage. We've been working with the agencies and other entities, we've been doing a lot of wildlife awareness, so educational, getting people who live there or live there only part-time to understand that they live in bear country. You have to have different behavior when you live in bear country. You have to bring in your bear, your dog food, your bird feed. You have to know that your barbecue grill is an attractant. We've been pretty successful with that, but we need to be more successful. Bears die at the hands of people, and people are at risk when there are bears around. There are tools to prevent both of those, and that's what we're working on. But we need to do more. It's become a real emphasis of ours. We will only have bears here if people let them.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Caroline Bird, Executive Director of the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, and Scott Christensen, its Conservation Director, about what I'll call transition in effective conservation strategy. Scott, you're out in the field trying to implement this new policy. I'm going to suspect that in part of your work you run into working class people who either earned their living from logging or ranching, and if they look back over the last 25 or 30 years, if you say Greater Yellowstone Coalition, they say, oh, those people that interfered with our ability to earn a living. How serious a problem is that as you reach out trying to get people to cooperate with you to protect bears?
You know, it's an issue that we confront every day in a lot of different places and around a lot of different things, even beyond grizzly bears. I learned to fly fish growing up on the Henry's Fork of the Snake in eastern Idaho, and you know, that was in the early or mid-80s, and there weren't grizzly bears around Island Park. And so, as you know, we talk about this theme of change and transition. You know, in my lifetime, and I'm a pretty young guy, I've seen a lot of change both in people's attitudes and then just where grizzly bears are found in our region. And, you know, I've worked with people down in the Henry's Fork over the last 7 or 8 years to give people the tools they need to feel safe and comfortable living around bears. And a couple of those people that I've bumped into have had interesting stories and experiences living in bear country. One of them is a guy named Rich Piney who runs a fly shop called Trout Hunter down on the Henry's Fork. And Trout Hunter was one of the first businesses to bring in a bear-proof dumpster for their business and secure their garbage. And Rich lives a stone's throw from the river and from the fly shop, mm-hmm. and he's an active hunter. And several years ago, he was bow hunting near his house and was mauled by a grizzly bear.
Mauled?
He was indeed. And he surprised a bear. He escaped relatively unscathed. He had some injuries on his arm and his hand.
Lucky fellow.
And was able to get back and get medical attention quickly. But the thing that has struck me about a guy like Rich is that he's making, you know, his living off of the resources in the Henry's Fork, the river, the open space, the wildlife. People come because of that.
How does he feel about the bears? I mean, here's a guy that both benefits from the aura of the Greater Yellowstone but was mauled by a grizzly bear.
You know, Rich is still an advocate for grizzly bears, and I respect him tremendously for that. And you know, I look at people like Rich who live in places where there are bears and who you know, take their clients out into the country mm-hmm. where there are bears, and they are some of the most powerful and effective advocates for bears. And the respect I have for somebody like that is tremendous, whether they're a fly fishing guide, whether they're a rancher, a logger. And those people are the people that make decisions every day about whether bears are going to succeed and survive or not.
I go back about 25 years in Montana and a cowboy here in the 60s. I think it's not a stretch to say a lot of people in the old days and not so old days, attitude toward bears and wolves was the old triple S, shoot, shovel, and shut up. You run into any of that out in your outreach?
I would say it's still there, but I think it's changing. I think our perspective is that if people have the tools and the resources, bear-proof containers, electric fencing, range riders out with cattle, I think that that builds social tolerance for living around bears, and that ultimately is our goal. You know, if we can give people the tools that they need to be safe around bears, then they're gonna be generally okay with having bears on the landscape.
Interesting thing, just in the old rural subdivision where I have a log cabin near Reynolds Pass, I was very interested in the response to the shooting of the sow. The people were really upset. It was very interesting. They weren't saying right on. They were saying, this is terrible.
People take pride in these animals when they can live safely around them.
Caroline, it's one thing to talk about dealing with the community and government agencies, but let's bring it closer to home. Any organization like yours, a not-for-profit, has a board of directors and donors. And for a long time, that board of directors and donors have been oriented toward this sort of quote-unquote protection activities we talked about before, some of it pretty hard-edged, lawsuits, arguments, differences of opinions, and some degree of mutual animosity with different elements of any community that you live in. How tough has it been for them to shift gears, to the extent that some shifting of gears is required, to begin to reach out to some of the people who in the past they would argue with? That's not necessarily easy.
The board wants us to be relevant and effective and successful. And as far as donors,
yeah,
I think people give to inspiration and success rather than desperation and the sky is falling. We can't say the sky is falling. Yet do we face some serious threats? You bet we do. But is the sky falling? Not when we're seeing grizzly bears in places we haven't seen them in decades. Are we succeeding? Do we need to continue to succeed? Do we need to have effective ways to make sure bears thrive and persist and expand? Yes. That's the picture we need to paint, and then we need to have success to back it up.
Scott, I'd like to ask you this on a personal level. I understand from an earlier discussion that your grandmother has passed away, but that your granddad is still alive.
Correct, yeah.
After all this time, how does he feel about you and your work? Not so much about you personally as his grandson, but any progress in finding common ground there? That's cutting it pretty close to home.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, my grandparents have always been, you know, proud of me, I think, as a grandchild. But, you know, I think that over time, as they have learned more about what I do and how we work, I think that they have a better understanding and appreciation for the outcomes that we're seeking, and I really believe that we can't seek outcomes, conservation outcomes, that don't take into account the people and communities that live here. And I believe that if we leave them out of the equation, that our outcomes, our victories for conservation aren't durable in the long term.
Caroline Bird, Scott Christensen, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.